My name is Joe McKeever. I'm 75 years old. I'm a preacher. And I'm a widower. I didn't volunteer for any of this. God did it all to me. He saved me, called me to preach, gave me my wife, and in time he took her back. The Lord giveth, the Lord taketh away. He does not ask our permission. And giving my wife back to the Lord was probably the hardest thing I've ever had to do in my life. I want to tell you about it. And AFA has given me an opportunity to talk to you. So I'm on the subject of grief and dealing with it. My wife would get a kick out of that because she knows that these are not subjects that I come by easily. She was the one who knew about emotions, and we would sometimes talk about how that if we went to see a movie, she wanted to go to the one where everybody was having nervous breakdowns, and I wanted to go see Andy Griffith. My family has a story about a cousin of mine who was a little older than me, so this happened before I was born, but she came to live with the family on the Alabama farm with our grandparents. And she was there, I guess Jacqueline was probably 6 or 7. And the family was sitting around, they were talking about what old people talk about, you know, major things, adult things. And Jacqueline had about all she could stand. And finally she said, "Let's talk about good things like candy and little calves." Margaret would say, "Joe likes to talk about candy and little calves." And I plead guilty. Margaret and I met when she was a senior in high school in Birmingham. And I was a sophomore, a new student, a transfer student at Birmingham Southern College. I was living for a short time with my sister and her husband and their one-year-old child. My sister is with us today. And they had just moved to Birmingham. We were trying churches, looking for one like the church back in the country. And we didn't find one of those. In fact, the Lord sent us to this huge church. And I discovered that it had the most wonderful fellowship and great Bible teaching ministries. And one day I noticed this 17-year-old. She was a looker. She would stop traffic. And but there are a lot of nice-looking people in the world, so that itself did not get me. What got me was the day that I noticed Margaret speaking to a youth group in church, a group of her peers. And she was so eloquent and self-confident and intelligent that that's what blew me away. When I finished Birmingham Southern, I just turned 22, and we married the next month. She was a couple of months shy of her 20th birthday. We do not recommend getting married that young, but nevertheless, we did. And you know what a cultural shock she had when she went from that huge church where she had belonged all of her life with her young preacher husband up the road to Kimberley to a church that was running 30. The music program was almost non-existent. In fact, it was better when the pianist did not show up. But what Margaret had a hard time with is she's 19 years old, 20 years old, and people are calling her Sister Margaret. She made the adjustment. In fact, that's sort of the story of her life, being a pastor's wife. She made the adjustment. In time, she would run television cameras in our church. She would teach adult classes in our church, teach classes of experiencing God. And in our last pastorate, we pastored 6 churches for 42 years. And in our last church, she and I team taught the auditorium Bible class. About 60 or 80 people just scattered across the auditorium. We put two stools there in front of the church, mic'd both of us, and we did not know what the other was going to say because we are so different. We came at these things from such different angles. We decided it was actually more fun to get up there and let this be real and genuine. And somebody came up with a good analysis one Sunday. They said, "Brother Joe, we'll tell you what the Hebrew says, and Miss Margaret will tell you what it means on Tuesday." And that was pretty good analysis because she was the practical one. She kept it real and kept me earthbound, my feet on the ground. And I miss her every day. As I say, we were married 42 years. We had two sons, and we adopted a daughter from Korea. And so we have two sons and a daughter. We have 8 grandchildren. And last 10 years of her life, Margaret had a lot of health issues. She had always been very active, walker, but now she ground to a halt. She had, none of them were life-threatening as far as we knew, but altogether they made life miserable. She had arthritis. She had fibromyalgia, which means you live with pain. And imagine on top of that, she had Crohn's. Now, Crohn's won't let you out of the house. In fact, sometimes it won't let you out of the bathroom. And we had originally thought that when I retired, that we'd be traveling, and I get a lot of invitations to preach. I still do. In fact, I'll be in Kentucky later on this week. And that she would go with me. But then she got to where she couldn't even leave the house. And she didn't like me to tell pastors who invited me to preach what her health issues were. She said, just tell them my wife has health issues and can't come. Generally, what I would tell them, they would say, and will your wife be with you? I would say, no, she's heard me. And that satisfied them for some reason. On last January, the 23rd was a Friday. And we did that morning as we always did. We had about an hour at the breakfast table. It happened sort of spontaneously a long time earlier, and I can't even tell you when we started doing this. I wake up early. I'm an early riser. I'd wake up about 4:30, not because I wanted to, but because the inner clock goes off and there's no point in lying here any longer. I'd get up and do my praying, and I would walk a couple of miles in the neighborhood, and I'd come in, I would make the coffee and make her a pot of tea. Now, I am lost in the kitchen, but she taught me how to make her a pot of tea. And so then I'd set it over and let it steep, and I'd get my laptop and put it at the breakfast table there and work on my blog, my article for my website, which is just my name, joemckeever.com. And along about 6 o'clock or so, I would hear her stirring. So I would pour a glass of a cup of her tea and put the sweetener in it and the milk and microwave it, have it hot, sitting at her place when she came in. She didn't want to talk. She's not a morning person. And so she'd sort of grunt to me, and she'd sit there, and after a little bit, she began to get awake, and then she'd want to know what I was working on or read me the one you wrote yesterday. Sometimes I would say, I've sort of reached a stopping point on this article and I don't know what to do with it. Would you mind listening? And she was always ready to listen. Margaret was not a writer, but she was a constant reader and always had good instincts about these things. And she would listen, and she would sometimes say, well, that's boring. Or she might say, well, so who do you think is going to be interested in this? I tell pastors, every pastor needs somebody in your life who can say that to you. Somebody, you know they love you, they're committed to you, but they can say, that's dumb. I don't have that anymore. I've had several friends volunteer, but. So we would sit there for a while, and then she'd get the paper and read it, and we'd talk about whatever she found interesting. And all the while, I'm over here working on my article, and she'd fix herself some breakfast. And when she finished, after a while, she went back to bed. And when I finished, I'd put the laptop away and go take a shower and get dressed for the day. This particular day, January 23rd, I had actually, after my getting dressed, I was lying on a bed in the back bedroom reading a Western novel. Along about 10 o'clock, she called down the hall and said, I'm going to drive myself down to the nail salon and get a pedicure, and I'll be back. And my last words to my wife of over 52 years was, okay. And along about noon, the phone rang, and this lady said, this is Ochsner Hospital. Who's speaking? I said, Joe McKeever. She said, we have your mother. I said, my wife. We have your wife here. You need to come to the emergency now. I said, why do you have them? She said, sir, you need to come to the emergency. I said, she's got the car. Sir, you need to come to, I said, thank you. Hung up the phone, called my daughter-in-law. My son lives a mile from us, and my daughter-in-law is the pastor secretary at our church, but she is off on Fridays, and she was just putting the groceries away, and she drove over and got me. We went to the hospital, and the emergency doctor came out and said, your wife, we think she had a massive heart attack in the nail salon. Said, your wife went over 1 hour with no heartbeat. So we know she's had extensive brain damage. We don't know to what, but we don't know the details. And that was Friday. We called the family in. One of our sons lives in North Carolina, our daughter in Springfield, Missouri. And they came in, and the grandchildren and everything. And that started our vigil in the intensive care for the next several days. That night, I drove to the nail salon because our car was still there. And I went in to pay the ladies who worked there, because I knew that in all the excitement, nobody had thought about them. They said, sir, we didn't do anything. They said, your wife sat in the chair, coughed a couple of times, and collapsed. The women who worked there are Vietnamese, and they didn't know what to do, and they went next door to the laundromat and called a man over, and he saw what was happening, dialed 911. The police station is a block away, and the fire department's about a half a mile away, so they were there just immediately. But she didn't respond to the defibrillator or anything. And 5 days later, next Wednesday night, after having had no response from her in ICU with all the things they had done, my children and I decided, let's go ahead and sign the papers and authorize them to unplug and disconnect the life support. And then next morning, about 10 o'clock or so, Thursday morning, January 29, we were in the room when she took her last breath. A friend of ours who's a medical doctor who works for the International Mission Board for our denomination and comes down occasionally to see us. She said, Joe, I think Margaret died in the nail salon on that Friday. You know, I have told you I've been a pastor for all these years. I have done probably 1,000 funerals. Did a funeral for my grandmother, helped my brother who's a pastor with funerals for our parents and 2 brothers, and you think you can handle about anything, you can't. This is the heaviest blow I've ever had. And I used to stand in the ICU when nobody else would be there. I would hold her hand. I loved the touch of her hand. We'd sometimes be driving, and I'd just reach over and touch her, just hold her hand, because her hand was so soft and so warm. I don't know whether I told her this, but I thought it many times. I believe I could pick her hands out in a room full of hands in the dark, because the touch was just so special. And I would hold that warm, sweet hand in the hospital room, and I would sing to her, recite scriptures, and talk to her and pray. And several times I said, honey, you would be so surprised that I'm crying so much, because I was never a crier. But sometimes life hands you a blow that you don't know what to do with, and it just explodes inside you. When she died, I came into the house, went into the bedroom where she had been staying for the last few years. She had taken over the guest bedroom because her sleep habits were so erratic. She just moved herself in there. And I got a garbage bag out of the kitchen. And I went through that room, gathering up all those pamphlets on fibromyalgia and celiac disease. And I picked those things up and I said, goodbye fibromyalgia and goodbye arthritis and goodbye pain and goodbye Crohn's disease and goodbye depression and goodbye weight loss. The former things have passed away. He has made all things new. Praise God, from whom all blessings flow. And I just dissolved into a puddle there in the carpet and cried and had a little revival. I will tell you, as much as I miss her, I wouldn't bring her back for the pain that she was in. There are many, many times when she would say, it's just constant pain. Now, I'm one who knows no pain. I'm the most pain-free person that you know. And there are many times I would tell her, and I would tell the Lord, I would be glad to take her pain or some of it. And she would just be so hurting so badly. And so there were times she would say, I can't live this way. And more than once she said, if I knew that it wouldn't hurt my family so bad, I would just end my life because the pain is so great. And so I cleaned all of that stuff out of the room. And man, I put it in a garbage can and had a little revival there. It is gone. It's gone. Praise God, from whom all blessings flow. We had her funeral. That was a Thursday when she died. And we had her funeral on Monday at the church. I don't know if it's possible for anybody to enjoy their funeral, but she would have. She would have been amazed, first place. Huge crowd. And old friends came in from long distances and flew in and drove in. Our best man was there from our wedding 53 years earlier. He's in his 80s now, and he and his son drove over from Atlanta. And our two sons and the pastor were the only ones who spoke. And they were wonderful. They were really wonderful. But the musicians were from three of the churches that we had served. One of them led a song my sons chose, When We All Get to Heaven. Another one led Great is Thy Faithfulness. And another minister of music and his wife and child, and they're all precious friends, they sang a song by Isaac Watts based on Psalm 23, My Shepherd Will Supply My Needs, the name of it. And Margaret and I and her sister Betsy used to sing that as a trio when we were dating. We sang it on numerous occasions, and I hadn't heard it since. And it was just so precious. And when we had cremated her, she had said that she wanted to be cremated. In fact, I have to tell you that she and I had that conversation, you know, if you and your spouse sometimes have a conversation about, you know, do you want to be buried, where you want to be buried, and this sort of thing. And we had talked about it, and the plan was, she had said, we figured that with her health problems that she would go first, and both my parents lived to be in their mid-90s, so I've got the genes, please Lord. And she wanted to be cremated and said, then when you die, just put the ashes in the casket with you, and that's the plan. And so we had brought home the little mahogany box with her ashes there and put in the living room. A few weeks earlier, I had cleaned off a little table and had put it there beside the chair in the living room where Margaret sat and did her devotionals each day. And she had her Bible there, this Bible there, and then the Amplified Bible and the Message from Eugene Peterson and her little journal that she kept. And so I put that little table there with nothing on it, and that became where we put the mahogany box. And what I was going to tell you, though, is that after we did her funeral, we came over to the fellowship hall, and the church had lunch for us. And everybody stayed, and we had, you don't call it open mic, but that's what it amounted to. Anybody who wanted to could go to the microphone and share a memory of Margaret, and the first one to do so was our best man. And he told how he was not a college student when we were rooming together. He was working, but we were in church together. He godly man that God sent as my roommate. I was the one in college, but we would lie awake at night and talk about the girls. And he would say, did you see Maggie? And that's the sharpest, everybody called her Margaret Maggie. I have to tell you, I called her Maggie until the day her dad called me down on it. We had just started dating, and everybody in our youth group was calling her Maggie. I still remember, her dad was a 6'3" Greyhound bus driver. And I still remember the day, and I had just met him. I was sitting on the carpet in her living room with my back against the couch, and he walked in with his uniform on. He's kind of imposing. And I had called her Maggie, and he stood over me, and he said, her name is Margaret. We named her Margaret. I said, yes, sir. So she was Margaret thereafter. Everybody in the group still calls her Maggie. I call her Margaret. But Joel Davis came in from Atlanta, our best man, and he told about how he was responsible for putting this together. And then, this is so funny, after he finished, some dear friends from Atlanta who had flown in went to the microphone. Now, Darlene and Margaret had done college together at MUW in Columbus. And now they didn't do it as 18-year-olds, they did it as 35-year-olds. And They were big buddies all the way through. And her, Darlene's husband, Jim, and I were best friends. And their daughter, Brandy, was best friend with our daughter. So this really worked out. So they have come over now for the funeral. And so they went to the microphone. And Darlene is telling about some of the things that Margaret said over the years. And she brought the house down by saying, and Maggie taught me that it was all right to say damn. I just said, what? The whole place just erupted in laughter. Now, I've thought about that since, and I thought, this is, again, is one of the differences between Margaret and me, because I'm the preacher. I would never do something like that. She's the one who, as I say, kept my feet on the ground, and it's just one of the many differences between us. Now, this is a big thing I want to say to you. The fact that I am here talking to you about grieving for my wife does not mean we had a perfect marriage. See, that would be a mistake to say, well, only those, you know, Christians with perfect marriages can do this. No. Our marriage was a whole lot like yours, maybe even more so. Our backgrounds were so different. Margaret came from my dad was a coal miner and a farmer, and my mother was a farmer's daughter, and they came from stable home lives. And Mama took care of the house. And my sisters, who are here, one's 2 years younger and one's 2 years older than me. I'm the fourth child. And so the guys worked in the field, four boys. We worked in the fields, and the women took care of what's in the house. And Daddy never washed a dish, never swept anything. Mama and the girls did that. So I grew up, you know, with this kind of, Mom and Dad never yelled at each other. They told each other they loved anything. Well, Margaret's family was the opposite. Yelling each other, that's like saying good morning. I was surprised when we started dating to see that her little brothers and sisters would be up at midnight on school nights. And then the next morning, the mother is yelling at them to get them to school, and it's a frightening place in the morning, so you don't want to be there. And so when we got married and Margaret started yelling at me, I thought the marriage was over. And then she had to say, just relax, this is how I do things. And so it took a little adjustment on both our parts. We were so different in a lot of ways. And that difference is part, you know, I tell these young couples who are getting married, you're attracted by the differences, but those differences will also destroy your marriage unless you learn to work with them and to appreciate them. And our first church after seminary, we moved to Greenville, Mississippi. And so I'm 27 years old, Margaret's 25, we got two little boys. And I actually left her at the house with boxes still left to be opened and unpacked so I could get to the hospitals and visit sick people, because I said to her, this is a larger church than what we've been having down the Bayou Country, and I've got to hit this at a run. That came out during marriage counseling a few years later. Now, I look back, I'm ashamed. I was ashamed then of what I had done. But what I did not, nobody told me, and I should have known, is that, you know, this church has been a year without a pastor. It won't hurt them to go one more week. And your family needs you. Unpack the boxes and hang the pictures and help your family get adjusted to the new house. But nobody told me that, and I didn't know it. And that's kind of symptomatic of the kind of husband that I was. And she had a hard time dealing with it. And there was a time then when she asked me to go to counseling with her. Now, this is, again, we're in our late 20s. And I said, no, I'm not going to counseling. In fact, I said something that should have gotten me a swift kick by somebody. I said, you don't understand, lady, I'm the counselor, not the counselee. Well, she named a preacher, Dr. James Richardson at First Baptist Church of Leland, a few miles over from Greenville. Do you mind if I go see him? I said, no, he's a good guy, a favorite friend of ours. She went over, had one visit, and it really helped her, and she came home, and she started doing things differently, and I started doing things differently, and it really blessed us. But 10 years later, we were pastoring then First Baptist Columbus, Mississippi, And one day she said, if you don't go with me for counseling, I'm out of here. That'll get your attention. First place, I didn't want her to be out of here. And second place, when a minister's wife leaves, it's pretty well it. And so we found out there was no counseling, no marriage counseling in our city, none. But there was in Meridian. Now, that's 90 miles away. And for the next year, twice a month, we made that 90-mile drive. And then, because we had come so far, we stayed with the counselor for 2 hours, twice a month. Sometimes those hours would be us fussing and hollering at each other, and sometimes it'd be us weeping. But invariably, our drive home would be the same way. We would be empty and exhausted, just wrung out. Well, after a year or so, we decided we had kind of reached a point where we could handle it now, and that was late 70s. In 1981, we took a Sunday night. Our church staff suggested this, take a Sunday night and tell how God healed your marriage. And I asked Margaret, do you want to talk? And she said, no, you do it. And so we still have tapes of that. In fact, I got a written transcript somewhere. I took about 45 minutes and told what we'd been through, just the conflict we'd had, the different expectations and different personalities and everything. And then went to counseling. And at the end of it, Margaret was on the front row. And of course, we packed the place out. If you want to get a crowd, just tell them how you and your spouse, you know, the pastor and spouse almost had a divorce, and that'll get them there. And I said, honey, you want to add anything? And she said, well, just a word. And she got up for 15 minutes and talked about it. Well, I was kind of glad to have that done. And two things happened as a result of it. The next week, my phone rang off in the office with people wanting to come by and talk about their marriage because the pastor understands now that we know what he's been through. The other thing that happens, we got this phone call from the Office of Communication for our denomination in Nashville. They said, someone from our office happened to be in your congregation Sunday night. They heard your testimony. We'd like to send a reporter down to interview you and your family and do an article for Christian Family Week the first week of May of that year. And I said, I don't know. I mean, there's not a preacher anywhere who wants to volunteer for this. I called Margaret and I said, what do you think? She said, oh, good, I knew God was going to use this. I said, thanks a lot. And they wrote the article, and it appeared in every one of our denomination's state Baptist papers, and a lot of secular papers like the Houston Chronicle ran it. And I got all sorts of letters from people thanking me, saying that God used that to even turn their marriage around and help them to go get counseling. Well, that's my wife. Then she's the one who just made so much difference in my life. And now the Lord took her. But you know, if you had told us when we got married that we'll have 52 years, we would have taken that in a heartbeat. That sounded like a long time, but nobody told us how quickly it would go by. And it was just over. And of course, nobody gave us any warning. And suddenly she was gone. My sister-in-law helped me go through the house, you know, and kind of pick up things. My sister-in-law, Susan, is 11 years younger than Margaret. In fact, Margaret helped to raise her, and these two are joined at the hip. In fact, they look just alike. The funny thing is that Susan looks like Margaret, and Susan's husband, George, is white-headed with the white facial hair and looks like me, and people came into the funeral and saw Susan and George sitting there, and they did a double take because they thought they were seeing Margaret and Joe. But one of the things we did, one of our Facebook friends said, send me some of the dresses of your wife and I'll turn them into a quilt, which she did. And we've got that quilt now on one of the beds there at the house. That's very precious. I have to tell you, the night of the funeral service that evening, we're all back at home now, my children and their families, the eight grandchildren, they're not babies. Now, the youngest one's 13 and the oldest is 25, but they don't see each other very much because three in Missouri and two in North Carolina and the three in New Orleans area. And they adore each other. And at one point, I heard laughter coming from the living room. Now, the living room's where the mahogany box with her ashes is sitting right there. And the laughter is these kids. And I stuck my head around the corner And they were in a circle on the floor playing some sort of game, slapdash or something. They've told me what it is. And they were just having the biggest time, sitting up close and touching and laughing and hollering. And I thought, 5 feet behind them is that mahogany box with the ashes, with their grandmother who adored them and whom they adored. And she would have loved this taking place right there. In fact, she's responsible for every one of them being here. She gave birth to our two sons, and the daughter, who was adopted from Korea, this was her doings. In the early 1970s, the Vietnam War was winding down, and all the news would talk about how that children in Vietnam are being burned by napalm from the bombing. And there was a hospital in Da Nang that was repairing the burned bodies of these children, and they were short on funds, and so we began sending money to that hospital from time to time. I came in one day at lunch. I was on staff at First Baptist Church in Jackson, Mississippi. I came in for lunch one day, and she was sitting there reading Newsweek in tears. And it was another story about these children. She said, "Isn't there more that we could do?" And I said, "Well, maybe we can send 25 a month instead of occasionally." She said, "No, I mean like adopt one of them." And I said, "What? Honey, you don't just adopt a foreign child." And she saw how close I was to it, and she dropped it. And not long after that, 2 or 3 weeks later, I'm in revival down the Florida Panhandle. And I was up one morning watching the Today Show, and Barbara Walters was on it back then. And she said, "This morning, we're talking about how to adopt a Vietnamese child. You'll want to get pencil and paper and write this down." And when have you ever heard them telling you to get pencil and paper and write this down? So when I got home, for the only time in our memory, Margaret unpacked my bag, and here in my handwriting was a sheet of paper, how to adopt a Vietnamese child. She had a little revival between herself and the Lord. Well, we picked out the most Christian of these outfits that they had told about in Eugene, Oregon, and wrote for information. And over the period of the next year or so, as we prayed about it, we asked God to choose our child. And we said, we've had babies, so we don't have any emotional need to have babies. We've had boys, we'd like to have a girl. And the information said that children after age 4 were almost unadoptable. So we said, we'll take one up to age 6. And in January of 1974, when they offered us the child, I noticed it said she was Korean. But the social worker said, this agency has orphanages in both countries, and they have far more children in Korea than in Vietnam, and it's easier to get them out of Korea. But if you turn her down, they'll turn right around and offer you a Vietnamese child. And we said, give us a day or two to pray about this, because we've asked God from the beginning to choose our child. And a day or two later, I called her back and I said, how do you turn down a child because she's the wrong nationality? And so a little girl, 5 years old, her name was Kim Jin Oak, J-I-N and O-K. Kim Jin Oak being like her first name. And so in May of 74, Margaret and I flew to Kansas City and met the plane coming in, bringing these children. And as I tell my 3 granddaughters, who are her children, I said, when the plane was pulling up to the window, I was thinking of you. They said, you were thinking of us? I said, yes. As the plane was pulling up, it hit me. There's a little girl on here who's someday going to make me a grandpa. I said, had I known that it would be Leah and Jessica and Joanne, I would have been beside myself with joy, because they are such prizes. The plane came up, and the people got off. All the other children were babies. There was one 5-year-old, and that was ours. And she didn't know any English, and we just had a list of Korean words. But I got to tell you this, when Margaret and I got married, we said, we're going to have a boy for me and a girl for you. So we had Joe Jr. He goes by Neil, the middle name. The second one we thought would be a girl, and we weren't going to name her Margaret. We were going to name her Marsha or something like that. Well, it turned out to be John Marshall. And his grandmother named him Marty, so he's been Marty ever since. But we never had the girl for Margaret. Now, the name Margaret comes from the Greek Margaritas, which means pearl. And so we're in the airport in Kansas City waiting on the plane. There was a Korean man there, and my wife walked up to him and said, sir, what does Jin Oak mean in Korean? He said, it means real pearl. I said, how about that? God's given us our daughter. And so he did. She Margaret would sometimes tell the children, "You were born in, the boy was born in my tummy. Chinookie, we call her Carla now, was born in my heart." So they were there. She loved these children. I have to tell you this, when this little insight about Margaret, probably the high point of her life in the 1990s when Grant was born, the first grandson, and he was born, they live a mile from us. So this, the others, my daughter was living in New Hampshire when the children, her children were born. But my son lives a mile from us, lives in Metairie, Metro New Orleans. And when Grant was born in 1994, and Julie went back to work, our daughter-in-law, and Margaret kept him 4 or 5 days a week. And it was all she did all day. She kept that baby, devoted herself to him. And when he got to where he could talk and everything, they just, it was kindergarten. It was just, they did Bible stories and everything all day long. She said to me one day, "I was born to be this child's grandmother." I have to tell you, it hurt when he grew up. She would have kept him as a 3-year-old, I think, all of her days. People who are grieving, they're always looking, well, what did I do wrong? You know, did I, you know, I feel guilty over what I, you know, the things that I did wrong with my wife. Well, none of us got it all right. We've all made mistakes. And so it's something occurred to me just this week, a delightful memory that I smile when I think about it, because it was a gift that she gave me, but it started out by me giving her a gift. It was her birthday in 1988, and we were pastoring First Baptist Church of Charlotte, North Carolina, and we were having a tough time of it. That church was going through a lot of difficult stuff there, and we only stayed there a little over 3 years before moving to New Orleans. And she had asked me one day to handle the stress. She said, "Do you mind if I take dancing lessons at Fred Astaire?" Well, Margaret, you know, was a city girl. She grew up as a teenager dancing. Well, I grew up on the farm, and the mules didn't dance, you know, and so I didn't know how to, had no desire to. I'm a Baptist preacher, for Pete's sake. We don't dance. And so she said, "Do you mind if I, she had some money of her own, do you mind if I take lessons, ballroom dancing lessons at Fred Astaire?" I said, "No, go to him." So her birthday in 1988, it was my off day, and we were doing what we love to do in the North Carolina countryside, just driving country lanes. We would sometimes drive them not knowing where we were going to end up. You got a map, you know, eventually you'll find your way back. And she said, "Can I tell you what I want for my birthday?" "Yes, what?" She said, "Fred Astaire has open house tonight, and I would like for you to go with me." I said, "Margaret, don't ask me to do that." Well, she could be persistent, and she stayed with it. "I really want you to." I said, and I still remember, we were passing a farmhouse. I said, "Honey, you see that barn out there? I would rather stand on that barn naked than go to Fred Astaire tonight." Well, she said, she kept saying, "It's open house. You don't have to do anything. There'll be a lot of new people there." Reluctantly, I said, "Okay." Well, there was about 60 people there. It was a big open room. And so, you know, it's chairs around the wall. Okay, fine. After a little bit, they said, "All right, everybody get out here. We're just going to do a line dance, you know, like the bunny hop or something." So, well, I'm not going to be the only one standing against the wall. I can get out there and do that. And so after they did that a little bit, they said, "All right, everybody get a partner. We're going to dance." That's when I headed for the wall. And I got caught by one of these cute young female instructors wearing a spaghetti strap. And I blushed, and she said, "Come on, dance with you, Joe." I said, "I don't dance, Beth." She said, "No problem." And next thing you know, I feel like I'm touching an iron stove here, hot stove. You know, like I don't know where to put my hands here. Margaret came over in a little bit and salvaged me from this. But she said, "Honey, they're offering 2 30-minute lessons for $10. Would you come with me?" And the teacher is Mike Stowers. Well, Mike went to our church. He was a good guy, and he was teaching Margaret. She said, "He'll teach us both." Okay, so then at the second one of those, she said, "I have bought a year's worth of lessons, and Mike will teach us both if you'll come with me." And by now, I'd realized this is something that's doable, And I actually went to dancing lessons, ballroom dancing lessons with my wife for a year. And we enjoyed it. It was unlike anything this old farm boy had ever done. And over the years since, especially after we moved to New Orleans, the only time we'd ever dance would be if somebody got married and they had their reception at a public hall somewhere, you know, and had a disc jockey there playing. And we would get out there on the floor and dance. And it was enjoyable. And I think a lot of people thought, whoa, look at that. The pastor's wife are dancing. It's okay. She's my wife. How could there be anything wrong with it? I have to tell you, when my grandchildren, my granddaughters were little, I would get out there and they'd put their feet on my feet and we would dance. And I still remember one of them, Erin was about four, and she said, "Twirl me, Grandpa." And it was just the dearest thing. But a deacon's wife came over to us one time and she said, "I'm so glad y'all are dancing." She said, "Chuck would never dance with me because there's the pastor." And he said, "Now the pastor's out on the floor dancing too." I never danced with anybody but my wife. And it was a gift that she gave me, but it started out by me very reluctantly giving her one. So I look back at that and I say, I did a lot of things lousy. I was a failure as a husband in more ways than I care to count. But I did a few things right. And it was good. And it was good. And I thank God for it. I'll go ahead and end this session and come back in a little bit and just talk about some of the things about how to deal with grief and misconceptions about dealing with grief and this sort of thing. I'll end with this word from Job. It says it all. He said, "The Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." Amen.